As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. We're going to get a brief now. She's been very visible. Lisa Hornby joins us, head of U.S. multi-sector fixed income at Schroders. And Lisa, I really want to go to a general sentence buried in your note. The value is there for a decade. In bills, notes, and bonds, the value is extraordinary. Discuss that. Why is price cheap in fixed income?
Well, to be fair, we wrote that note about 4 or 5 weeks ago.
And it's moved. Fair.
It's moved. But when we look at bond yields today in the longer term, there is much better value than there has been certainly any time in the past decade. And in fact, if you look back, even going back 20 years, we're at the sort of top 25th percentile or so. And so, you know, in our view, the first 6-7 months of this year have been quite painful in return space. But when you look forward, we've now set the landscape for much better returns. We actually have income in fixed income now for the first time in a while. We couldn't make that case a year ago.
Lisa, spreads have tightened aggressively. You've seen that. We've gone from close to 600 basis points on high yield to threatening to break 400. Lisa, can you help me understand, just dissect that rally for us, where that strength has come from? Is that an up in quality trade? Is it everything? What's happened here?
I think it's a few things. I think the main one for us actually is that people have a bit more certainty in the rates volatility scenario. And what I mean by that is, I think you went back 3 or 4 months ago, people didn't know where the terminal rate belonged. I mean, you heard strategists talking 3, 4, 5, 6%. I mean, there were lots of expectations out there or lots of various scenarios. And that led to extraordinary high rates volatility and of course, the subsequent impact on credit spreads and equity markets, because if you can't price the risk-free rate, how can you price everything else? And I think what happened was not only did sentiment get so poor that positioning was perhaps a bit offside, but what happened was the Fed was perceived to do a slight pivot and show that they are willing at some point to slow the pace down, and that they think that they're getting fairly close to, you know, perhaps a neutral rate, you know, over long term. But I think people got comfort in the fact that the terminal rate is probably not 5 or 6%. It's probably 3 or 4%.
But Lisa, the Fed has said we haven't pivoted. No pivots going on here. And basically, we're expecting that to hear that in the minutes. Is that going to reverse some of the spread tightening that we've seen?
I think it will. I think that the market narrative shifted a bit, and that lower vol regime is positive for risk assets. And especially, it's more positive when sentiment had gone so far off sides. I mean, we look at that Credit Suisse panic euphoria index. It was -5 panic for months almost. Now it's back actually in positive territory. So there was a massive swing in sentiment. I think that coupled with that perception that the Fed became a bit more perhaps dovish led to the rally that we've seen. To your point, Lisa, in our view, this is a fade. I don't think the outcome that the market has painted, which is one, if you, you know, you look at what's priced in, the yield curve is inverted. That points to a recession. You look at what's priced into Fed funds rates. It's basically the Fed stops in February or March hiking, and they basically do an about face and start cutting rates in the summertime. I think that's a fairly unlikely scenario unless there's a really big downturn, which there could be. But then, should risk assets be priced the way that they are today?
Lisa, are bond markets as well as the Fed all just trading and operating around an oil market that's in flux?
I think oil is one part of it. Certainly that's, you know, that's going to lead to the headline inflation sort of gyrations. I mean, oil came off and so we saw a big drop down in CPI, headline CPI. But I think core inflation is more important. And that's really where the story is. And to us, that's a bit more concerning. You know, yes, there was maybe a little bit of moderation, but the sticky components of core inflation are still running north of 5-6%. And so to us, that's the real challenge. Yes, oil will have puts and takes that will drive headline, but you got to get core inflation down to more reasonable levels. And I think that's what the Fed is focused on.
Lisa, just listening to that final comment there, that just sounds like you think this debate over terminal rates is unresolved, that it's too early to get ahead of this story.
I think it's too early to be discounting Fed cuts, certainly. I think it's too early to be discounting the Fed has pivoted. I think that's not done yet. I do think that they probably moderate their pace in September to 50. Probably, you know, they could do a couple of 50s. They could do a couple of 25s. I don't think the 5 or 6% story is the one that, you know, people were fearful of at the very front of the year. I don't think we're getting there, but I think the market is pricing in this very specific outcome where we head into a very moderate or mild recession. The Fed is able to stop hiking and then start cutting. And that just seems unlikely. Historically, they don't cut when inflation is at elevated levels, unless growth is really, really bad. Unemployment is much higher than where we are today. So, you know, I think the market is getting a little too excited right now to be completely frank.
You know, I've always called that, Lisa, a bedtime story to help equity market bulls sleep well at night. And that's what that is right now. Lisa Hornby there of Schroders. Kit Jukes joins us now, Chief FX Strategist at SocGen. Kit, the first line in your note this morning, are markets listening to the Fed and ignoring them, or just not listening? Kit, which one is it?
I think they're choosing not to listen. I'm sure markets are listening to the Fed, but they're not really hearing the message, or, you know, there's a disconnect between some of the kind of optimism that a little bit less inflation means we'll get less from the Fed, and a Fed that's looking at high inflation anyway, I mean, way, way, way too high, and a labor market which, you know, is just incredibly tight now. And so they really have nowhere to go. And I will be surprised if we don't end up pricing a 4% Fed funds peak into this market before we're done over the next few weeks, because it seems to me that the message from the Fed is it cannot soften at all at this point.
Kit, what is the message of strong Swiss franc and particularly Euro Swissy breaking through 0.97 to 0.96? What is a signal of that sticking out like a sore thumb on a Monday morning?
It tells you a little bit about risk aversion. I mean, it tells you something about the fact that the Swiss decided that they wanted to get rates back into positive territory if they ever got a chance, and that they've got some inflation that they need to fight. And if they have to sacrifice all attempts to keep the currency down in the process, it's fine because dollar Swiss isn't a problem. So domestically, you can see what they're doing. But yeah, I mean, it's an extension of the China story from this morning that says the U.S. economy might still be doing well so long as we don't look at the yield curve and don't worry about the things that don't gel well with the U.S. economy. But if we look at the rest of the world, there's just a world of trouble out there.
Kit, you're talking about how perhaps this market is not listening to the Federal Reserve. And I wonder in this quiet summer week whether Wednesday will be a pivotal day in terms of Fed meeting minutes, whether they try to signal, hey, wake up, 4% Fed funds rate is actually a reality. Do you believe that this will be a catalyst for some sort of dollar strength, for more market disruption, as people kind of start to hear what Jay Powell was saying?
Hard to know for sure, because I think the last FOMC meeting was about stepping away from excessive forward guidance. So I don't know if they want to come back and steer us too hard. I think Jackson Hole's a different story, but I think they have a problem with the degree of overprecise forward guidance we've had from central banks in a very complicated and chaotic global economy. It just doesn't make sense. They should take the facts as they are. When they get them and move, they should have hiked in June last year, and so on and so forth. So I would be a little bit depressed if I thought that they were still using FOMC minutes to micromanage expectations. I would be more encouraged if they came out having seen the payroll data and having seen everything that we've seen since this month. If they came in Jackson Hole and said, look, you know, we have to get inflation back in its box.
Yep.
And we can only do that by putting some slack into the labour market.
And financial conditions just keep on easing, and that's been problematic. Lisa, I was reading through the notes last week, and pretty much every single note said the same thing. It looked like, to me at least, that we were equating peak inflation, Lisa, with peak Fed hawkishness. I'm not sure whether you can do that.
And a lot of people came out and basically said the Fed put is still a Fed call, and that the more that stocks rally, the more that the Fed's going to have to step in and do something to cause this to reverse. And how much is this going to become the reality and the talking point over the next few weeks?
Kid, would you summarize it as follows, as Lisa just called it? Is this a Fed call now? And does this Fed have to respond to this aggressive rally we've seen in this equity market, this aggressive tightening we've seen in credit spreads?
I don't think the market helps the Fed, but the reality is that inflation, that with the labor market where it is, and wage growth where it is as a result of that, inflation may drift lower over the course of the next 6-9 months. But they'll still have a problem because it's not going up back under 5% easily from here. So, you know, there's a two stage. So I think the Fed's messaging in sense of the Fed's problem is they don't have a choice. The inflation mandate requires action, more action. The market does what it does. The concern is that as soon as the market thinks they might have done enough, That's when you look at it and you think, no, they just haven't. Not until the data improve.
Okay, just quickly, as an Arsenal fan, did you enjoy two other London clubs just beating each other up for 90 minutes yesterday?
It was good entertainment, whatever else it was.
Kit, juice is sort, Jen. Kit, thank you.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Right now, we're going to rip up the script. We can do this with William Lee. He is chief economist at Milken Institute. We are going to talk to him about the empire statistics, but said, let's take advantage of his encyclopedic knowledge of the Pacific Rim and the dynamics of China. Of course, Dr. Lee has all of the efforts he's done at the International Monetary Fund over the years and Citigroup, and of course, holds a shingle out at the Milken Institute right now. Billy, I want to go to the party Congress right now. Elizabeth Economy of the Council on Foreign Relations, in her beautiful book, The World According to China, has the view of China looking out. How does Beijing and their leader in Beijing, how does he look within, giving the grim data of the day?
Actually, President Xi has made a major campaign of his to start looking inward. It's called the dual circulation strategy, where he wants to have the domestic economy become the primary focus for China and a source of growth going forward. Unfortunately, so much has collapsed within China that the domestic economy is nowhere to be found, especially in the private sector, where the only store of wealth the middle class had, the property sector, has completely collapsed. We've had about a year of declining real estate prices. So right now, the rest of the world is the only hope for China, and even that's collapsed because the latest data show the export numbers are nowhere to be found. So China really has nothing to hang on to going into the Party Congress.
How does Xi, Bill Lee, prosecute decisions, logistics, the process of it to Shanghai or to Chengdu? How does Beijing actually get the message out?
You know, right now there's a tension between the center, the central government, and the municipal governments. Because right now, the only place for revival is to have municipal governments go in there and do infrastructure building and just start pumping out fiscal policy. Unfortunately, every municipality out there is so indebted, they can't do it. And so the only thing that Xi Jinping has to have to save face going into the Party Congress in October is to have some prayer of saying, we will have a revival in the second half of the year. These numbers today have put that to rest, and there's no chance for that. On top of that, Speaker Pelosi has slapped him in the face, and the loss of face going into the Party Congress is going to be something that's going to be very hard for him to recover from.
Bill, we'll get to Taiwan in a moment. Just on the economy, are you describing a balance sheet recession in China?
A balance sheet recession for sure in the private sector, because the only source of saving for the households has been real estate and a very volatile stock market. And so with the collapse of the real estate market and the huge youth unemployment, it's very hard for households to have a positive outlook for the future and start buying things like consumer durables and other items. So the balance sheet recession notion is very much in play in China.
That leaves monetary policy impotent, doesn't it? And Bill, if that's the case, I'm just trying to work out where that leaves the global economy off the back of these dynamics starting to bubble to the surface just a little bit more.
The only place monetary policy can have a play here would be regulatory policy, to somehow ignore all of the holes that are in the real estate sector and say, OK, guys, go on and build. We're going to backstop all of your bad debt and all of those empty apartments of yours. That's the only place for monetary policy right now is the regulatory side. And China's not going to be able to do that because the regulatory sector, the real estate sector is in such bad shape.
So what are we looking at, Bill, in terms of GDP growth for China?
I hear two handles going into the rest of the year. And so in order for China to get to its 5.5% target, it has to have 7 and 8% for the rest of the year. And right now, it's exactly going the opposite direction.
Has the rest of the world economy factored that in, the likelihood in your idea that you could see a two handle for Chinese GDP growth?
I think that notion has gotten out, especially among my friends who are China chief economists out there. They can't publish it because they'd be banned from China. But I think the notion is among the investors of the world, well, this may be temporary and China will somehow recover because it always has. But the structural problems I just pointed out are just so severe. I think there's going to be a lot more work to be done for China to regain anywhere near its investor status.
What about the asset pricing, though, globally? And we're just talking about the Empire Manufacturing Survey, severely disappointed, second biggest drop in this history of this index, the second biggest just all-in level that we have ever seen in this index's history. How much are we looking at a global recession really pinning off the slowdown in China?
Well, manufacturing is really at the core of the globalization. That's the one sector that's most affected by globalization and China in particular, because it's been the nexus of manufacturing. So we would expect any kind of slowdown in China that affects the global supply chain to kill the manufacturing sector before anything else. And we are seeing that in the data now. So that's not so surprising. What is going to be difficult would be how the rest of the global economy will adapt its global supply chains in a way that it takes China out of the picture, or at least become less important part of the picture.
Bill, you said something moments ago, I'll paraphrase, that certain people can't publish things because they'll be thrown out of the country. Now, Bill, there's an element of truth in that in the minds of a lot of people. And I wonder if these things start to deteriorate just a little bit more, Bill, where I look for reliable data on what's actually happening in that economy.
Well, I hate to say this, but my sell side colleagues are kind of constrained. I'm lucky to be at Milken where I'm not constrained to say what I think. And I think it's going to be very difficult to find hard intelligence about China outside of private sources.
That's tough. Bill, thank you. Bill Lee of the Milken Institute.
Ellen Wald joins, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and really quite good on particularly the mix of what's going on in Saudi Arabia. Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today. Should we get used to oil at 80 or 90, or are you with a school of thought that normal is much higher and we're just on borrowed time down here?
I'm not sure we're necessarily on borrowed time, but I do think that for the current picture, that yes, higher is definitely a new normal. And when you look at the changes that are going on in the U.S. in terms of oil production and new regulations and different corporate outlooks towards increasing production, there's definitely a trend towards less dynamic responses to the market. higher costs in terms of production, slower increases in production. And so I think we definitely could be looking at a somewhat higher basis in terms of oil. And as you've been mentioning, inflation also does play a role in that.
And can I just pick up on some of this and ask you how durable this decline is going to be? We're south of $4 a gallon for gas in this country right now on average. We've seen numbers decline every single day going back to the middle of June. It's pretty impressive stuff. Secretary Granholm over the weekend to CNN hoping it continues. Do you have that same feeling that it will continue?
Well, I think that you also have to remember that seasonality is still a very important component in gasoline demand and gasoline prices. And generally around this time, we do see a slight dip in demand. School is starting for large portions of the country, and the summer driving season is coming to an end. But I think that what will really give us a good sense of where things are headed in terms of gasoline prices and demand is as we hit the fall, as we hit September, when refineries have to go into their maintenance season, I think we'll get a good picture of whether demand is still strong, whether it's going to drop off, because typically prices decline, but will refineries feel secure enough to even go offline to do maintenance, or will they feel pressure to keep churning out more and more barrels and kind of put off needed maintenance? And that could be a significant factor for gasoline prices for the rest of the year.
How big of a swing factor, Ellen, is COVID zero and China ending that after the National People's Congress later this year?
That would be a huge deal if China ended its COVID zero policy, because essentially the market is always kind of on edge. Is China going to shut down? Is this major city going to shut down? What's demand going to look like out of China? And to some extent, you get a little bit of a sense when they issue their import quotas, especially for the independent refineries, about how much oil they're going to be importing. But at the, you know, at the stroke of a pen, they could basically crush domestic demand. And so I think that if they do get rid of this zero COVID policy, I think that that will be quite telling for the market, especially for the next year.
Well, but how tight is production right now? How tight are supplies? And that's, I guess, the question that I have is, how resilient is the market to a potential shock in demand one way or another? Right now, we're seeing cooling demand. How low would those prices be if it weren't for that tightness?
Yeah, I think we could definitely potentially see prices, you know, down in the 60s if it weren't for that tightness. But on the other hand, part of the tightness is what is causing prices to cool down. The fact that they were so high because things were tight, and then we did see some demand destruction. We are seeing continued fears of global recession. You know, even if we do get more data out of Europe and Europe does plunge into recession, which I think most people think is going to happen, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're still not going to need oil, because prices, electricity prices there are still so high, and that could cause them to switch to some oil.
Ellen, the distinction to me in, say, a given 100-page research report is the potential demand of the Pacific Rim and even the Pacific Rim ex-China. Do you believe in that, that they're going to have the buoyant boom over 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? It's going to pop oil to a permanence above $100 a barrel?
I don't believe that that's necessarily going to be the case. I definitely think that there's room for an economic boom there, but I wouldn't say that that's definitely going to cause oil to stay above 100, especially if you're looking at, say, a major decline in European demand, if you're looking at economic weakness in America. Those could all be significant factors. And also remember that when the middle of December comes, or early December, that's when these sanctions on Russian oil are supposed to take effect. And I think that that will be very telling for where oil's going in the next year and in 2023, and how well these sanctions are actually enforced or adhered to.
The coast isn't clear. We've heard that a lot, haven't we? Ellen Wold there of the Atlantic Council, the brilliant Ellen Wold on the latest. Ellen, thank you.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.